All right, so it's 4:05, and I think it's time to start the show. This is episode 21 of Burrows and Burbs, and I'm very excited to introduce our two guests, Anna Shagalov and Bo Poulsen, who are part of the Poulsen-Shagalov team in Manhattan. And I believe your particular expertise, Bo, is eco-friendly and energy-efficient buildings. So we're going to talk a little about that. And I think Anna Shagalov's particular expertise is, tell me if I'm wrong, the lower half of Manhattan.
I mean, when you do this as long as I have, it's kind of all within the realm of expertise at this point. But thank you.
Well, I heard that you were particularly good at the lower half of Manhattan, but then Roberto said, but then again, she sold $30 million in the Benson, so I guess she really is expert at the whole island.
Well, that was Bo's contact actually, and it was from since the time that Bo and I paired up, it's been a team effort. So.
All right, so I'm going to put the Benson on the screen, and why don't you tell us a little bit about the Benson and why it matters?
Wow. Why does it matter? It matters
Neftali's listening.
it matters because there's very few well-designed new developments that really fit in with a neighborhood. And I think the Benson is that. You know, it's a 15 CBW type of building where, you know, they had Peter Penry, they had blanking on their architect, Yellowbird design team in there. They just had a great design team in there, and it just fits into Madison. And it's a small boutique building. There are very few apartment buildings that only have, I believe there's 16 units in the building. And my buyers actually were looking for a townhouse in the area. And they decided on this because they could do a combination of two apartments, which are both full floors, and then also have the services of, you know, a five-star luxury building.
Okay.
Were they foreign buyers?
They were not. They were locals.
But they never saw it, right? That's the story.
They never saw it, never went to the showroom. I've worked with them for years, you know, rented them a bunch of apartments, and we've been looking for a sale for I don't even I years, 4, 5, 6 years, something like that. So yeah, you know the story.
It's minimum wage.
Yeah. When it all comes together, yes. But
That's
yeah,
awesome.
no, I mean, it's a great building. You know, it's got some Central Park views, even though it's not on Fifth Avenue. And you know, you can't beat the location right there on Madison.
Just curious, when they decided to look at a building like that, did you introduce them to just that one building, or when they saw that, they're like, okay, we'll consider this, and should we look at two or three others just to compare?
We looked at just a couple other buildings, but there was nothing that compared to it. There was nothing else out there. They didn't want to be on like Billionaire's Row. You know, there was nothing along those lines that they want to be on. There's just so few boutique buildings that are west of Lexington up there. And they wanted to be on the Upper East Side, obviously, for, or not obviously, but they wanted to be on the Upper East Side for schools and stuff. So they, you know, most of the new developments are east of Lex.
Yep. Did they stay within the same price point for the townhouse and the apartment, more or less?
I mean, they probably could have gotten a townhouse for less than that, but you know, there's also, you know, when you buy an apartment like that, you know, it's a full floor, right? So you don't have wasted space. When you're living vertically, it's very different than living horizontally. And I think it's a lot easier for to live horizontally than it is to live vertically.
No,
I know that.
I have a client, a family, and they actually decided against the townhouse because they felt that it would not lend to them being a close family because everybody would be all spread out on different floors.
It's true. It's
So.
true. I mean, I get winded every day walking to the third floor.
But there's nothing green about that building, though, right?
What was that? Sorry.
There's nothing green or eco-friendly about that building.
No, unfortunately, you know, there was nothing. There was nothing that really. I mean, they use, you know, good quality insulated windows, and their insulation is okay. But no, there was nothing there that that appealed to my sense of eco-friendliness, unfortunately. But we did stipulate in the purchase that all paints had to be no VOC. The glues that they're using for a lot of things, you know, should be low VOC, all those types of things. So that's actually something that we asked about. And Naftali actually was pretty, was very open and forthcoming with that. And most of the products that they were using were low VOC products to begin with.
Did that come from the buyer or did you impose that?
I think it came from both. You know, I mean, I think the buyer knows what my sentiment is towards sustainability and towards healthy living. So it came from both sides. But they're super. I mean, my clients are extremely, you know, sort of health and environmentally conscious as well. So it just flowed well, you know, parallel.
So I want to turn to Anna as well, and I want to hear how the team came together. I know that you came from started in Russia of all places, and then came over here to Atlanta and found your way to New York. But Anna has been in New York since the very beginning. How did you guys get started as a team? And tell us how the partnership evolved.
Well, Bo and I have known each other since the beginning of our careers. And when we first met, we were instant friends. It was very easy. We both have very kind of laid back personalities and we just like to be as real as we can with each other. And we hit it off right away. So we were friends from the get-go. And Bo was at a couple of different firms. Bo, you were at City Habitat's Town. And then
stint of Compass.
And a short, yeah. So then, when it was announced, there was this big announcement that Bo Paulson team was coming to Halstead, and it was in one of our company meetings, and I'm texting him going, no way, are you really here? And we were very excited. And then do I tell them the what really happened, Bo, at the deal?
Sure. It involves some of this. No, I'm just kidding. This is
no, it's not. That's not it. So we're at deal of the year and we're talking, we realized we had some clients and friends that overlapped. So after a few shots of tequila, I said to Bo, we should team up. And I had actually been looking for something for a while because I was a solo shop for like 17 years at that point. I had assisted Barbara Galson for my first couple of years. And then after that, I was on my own and I really wanted to team up and collaborate and do bigger things. And he looked at me, he gave me this look like, we should talk tomorrow. And the next day we were trying to figure out whose name came first. Bo won, obviously. But it's been really seamless. It's been really wonderful.
I think that's a fantastic turn of phrase. I was ready to team up and do bigger things. And I want to hear about how the partnership works and how you guys feed off of each energy, off of each other's energy, and how you complement each other in order to win these big deals, do big deals, you know, and how it feeds the creativity. So talk to me more about how you guys work together.
Yeah, I mean, we like to have ideas. We think outside the box. We're like sometimes way outside the box that you almost have to reel us in, but we like to keep things really interesting and creative, just a little bit. We like to keep things interesting. And for me, I had all these ideas, but I didn't have the courage to do these things on my own because there's a lot of financial expenses that you know, you have to deal with on your own. And if something fails, you know, and there's also just the collaborative efforts that I was really, really missing. And I know Bo's work ethic. He knew mine. We had done some deals together in the past. We both knew how we communicated with other people and what was important to us as far as being ethical, being fair. It's never really the dollar signs that we're looking for. It's really just to service people in a way that they deserve to be serviced. So breaking the mold of what a broker used to mean. And I think there's a lot of people that do that now, which is great. But I mean, it's really, it's the events that we do now. So it's not really the bigger deals. It's more of the capacity of the marketing and co-hosting things and doing webinars and doing panel discussions and being able to just brainstorm with somebody that understands your way of thinking. And, you know, we've never said to each other, that is the worst idea I've ever heard. Never. Because there's everything always deserves to at least be discussed and to communicate. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But we've tried a number of things and everything has been wonderful.
I think it's also great to have a sounding board, you know, and somebody exactly. who you really feed off of. And Anna is great that way. I mean, and you know, I think what she was alluding to, I appreciate Anna actually not throwing me under the bus, but she should have, is that sometimes I get some harebrained ideas. And sometimes you need
somebody. I was going to say that off camera.
Sometimes you need somebody to like reel you in and be like, listen, let's focus on the most important things. You know, where do we need to focus right now? Especially like during something like a pandemic and things like that, where, you know, where's our core business and you know, how do we refocus on that? Because real estate's a roller coaster. I mean, you know, you guys know all the emotions we go through and everything like that. You know, we're always on a constant roller coaster. And so I think it's great to have somebody who can somebody sometimes also like give you the hockey check and be like, whoa, all right, slow down there. You know?
But I've never called any idea stupid. Never.
Not yet.
So how are you guys set up? You guys are the two principal people in your partnership. And then you have who kind of tears down from you?
We have Kristen, who's our coordinator. So she basically takes care of, you know, everything that we have. And she's transitioning over to being one of our main agents as well, because we're bringing somebody new in that actually just started. She comes from, Anna and I know her from like the title business,
but
she's actually going to be doing, Luciana is going to be doing all our coordinating, our social media.
Yeah. She was in legal. She was in title. She's very well rounded when it comes to real estate.
Yeah, and then we have Lina, who is a little bit sort of more under the radar. She has great contacts, but she basically is, you know, somebody who that we work with through her to acquire clients. And then unfortunately lost one of our very good agents, Zoe. She's Australian. She had to move back to Australia.
Although she did just do a couple of deals from Australia.
She did just do a couple of deals, yeah.
So you didn't really lose her yet.
We're doing a ton of deals. I think we got three or four in the pipeline with her. But yes, yeah. So she's actually doing more deals from Australia than she was here in New York. Which is great. We love it.
So I want to remind everybody who's watching that it's no mere partnership. Together, you've done over $500 million worth of sales, right? I mean, this is a long-standing partnership, hugely successful. You guys are doing something right together. And yet you've also carved out, I think, an identity for this brand in the market for being particularly good at green building. Is that right? So can you talk about, you know, where did that come from and how does that help the team?
Well, I think that was one of those things that was, you know, part of the collaborative thing. You know, when Anna and I first started talking about, you know, partnering up together, I was already sort of very focused on trying to promote green buildings for developers. And it's a difficult thing to do. It's not easy. And Anna sort of fit really well into that because she was like, I know people who are trying to do this and I want to do the same thing. And we started talking about not just green buildings, because I think that's sort of a weird term that sort of tries to encompass a lot of things. It's about energy efficiency. So it's an environmental aspect, but it's also about healthy living. So it's a combination of two to three different things. It's how you build the buildings, it's how you live in the buildings and how you treat your environment. So there's really three main aspects to that. And that's something that we've really found that we both could really wrap our heads around. And sometimes I think in our business, you know, we love to service our clients and that's what gives us joy. But sometimes you sort of lose track of what you're doing and you get into this sort of just train where you're just riding it and you don't see the bigger picture of real estate in New York. And so it's really sort of nice to be able to actually have something where we can contribute to how real estate is evolving in New York City.
And there's also
a development.
Sorry to interrupt. A lot of the materials are now just much easier to find. So to bring this concept to somebody years ago, it would have cost them a lot more to put these ideas together into an actual building or product to deliver. I mean, now, you know, it's a common conversation piece, and you know, developers are keeping their eye on it, and especially now with the pandemic. I mean, everyone is super concerned about healthy living and how to breathe clean air, and this is the right time for something like that.
Yeah, I mean, developers for years have spent, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars on you know, using Lefroy Brooks instead of Grollo or something like that, where, you know, there's just water coming out of the faucet, but they never thought about the actual water that's coming out of the faucet, you know?
Right, of course.
And that to me always sort of blew my mind, because developers were like, you know, I'm not going to go green because it's going to cost me exponentially more, yet they were okay with using, you know, the finest marbles from Italy and those types of things. And as nice as those things look, they don't actually, you know, help you live in a healthy home, which I think a lot of people are missing.
So what are some of the opportunities? By the way, I want to introduce you to Scott Hobbs. Scott Hobbs is occupying the cell underneath Anna on my screen. He's a builder, by the way, and he's sitting in the dark. And I think that's probably because he's trying to save energy right now. That's why he only got a 20 watt bulb in his office.
Isn't it a flashlight?
He may want to lead in here. If you say the word LEED, certified or platinum LEED, he may leap out of his chair and have an opinion. I'm just warning you about that.
Feel free. That'd be great.
I would love to hear it, because I have mine as well. I mean, I am actually the first broker and one of, I think, only two in New York who got LEED accredited. And it was probably the biggest waste of time that I ever did.
But you get to say that you are.
I get to say that I am. But yes, no, I'm a much more of a believer in building with passive house technology, net zero, things like that, than sort of a bureaucratic LEED system. But I'd love to hear what Mr. Hobbs has to say.
I mean, I basically concur under that. There's, you know, the only good thing under LEED is that it did actually change a lot of the zoning codes, or sorry, the building codes. And now, I mean, it's kind of a joke to get a LEED certified house, because I think basically every house is LEED certified. I mean, if you're going to build in a municipality like New York or Connecticut or New Jersey, almost like the Mara standards get you up to LEED already. So trying to go beyond that. And then at the same time, trying just to figure out that whole cost benefit side as to, you know, are you saving $10,000 are you spending $10,000 to save $100 a year? Or are you saving, you know, spending $500 in order to save $100 a year? And I mean, those end up being different items. And again, you just want to discuss them and figure out what you're doing and adjusted to also the environment that you're working in.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's so many aspects that fall in. One of my best examples is like, if you bring in wood from, let's say, Ohio on a truck, it actually pollutes more than shipping it from France on a boat. There's a lot of greenwashing going on, I feel like, especially in the LEED program as well, that, you know, you can build a building that you think you're living in this environmentally friendly and energy efficient building, but where they really got their LEED points was from something else. You know, it was the gravel that they used in the parking lot. There are much better, which is why I'm a big proponent of the passive house technology systems and also net zero, is, you know, there's much better ways of approaching this than the LEED system.
When we talk green, are we just talking about materials, or are we talking about a method of installation, labor, and is the labor more expensive to, you know, to use these items? Do you need a certain expertise?
I think a lot of it has to do with the air filtration systems and how tight the airflow within the seams of the building is. So I think it's more of a design based, but I Bo would probably know better if you need to be specialized. I don't think so.
Anybody can be taught how to put tape on a building, and that's really what it is taping up a building and then using the proper insulation and doing it properly. There's a lot of guys out there who do it wrongly, but you know, to actually do it right is not that difficult. There's a lot of builders, unfortunately, out there who don't know how to do it. So could you come into situations where somebody's going to charge you a little bit more because they are knowledgeable? Yeah, probably. But that's just a, you know, a supply and demand situation right now, where the demand is a lot higher than the supply of these guys. When I first did my house, for example, which is a passive house, I got two quotes from normal builders without doing a passive house that were higher than my passive house construction guys.
Define passive house. What's that mean?
Passive house is basically it's a guideline that was established in Darmstadt, Germany, by a professor, and he set these mathematical guidelines where you can actually type it into a computer on your window size, on the airflow that comes through your house. So they measure that basically by taking a big fan, sucking all the air out of your house, and then they can tell how much air is, you know, creating a vacuum, so they can tell how much air is coming into your house. And then also your installation. And so all those are put into a formula, and then it has to meet certain guidelines to become a passive house. But what you can do, though, is use the passive house technologies that are out there. You can put those together and not necessarily meet the passive house guidelines and still have an amazingly well done house. And even the passive house guidelines have changed now from just being focused on energy efficiency to being focused on sustainability, because those two things are very different. You know, so before, when a lot of people were using spray foam, like the passive house guys are like now saying, you know, don't use spray foam, use, you know, materials that are not going to off-gas chemicals, that are, you know, going to be a lot more sustainable. Woods, cross-laminated timbers, using rock sole, things like that.
So what I hear you saying is the first generation of being green meant to most consumers energy efficiency. Give me better insulation. Let me consume less energy. Let me insulate my windows, insulate my walls. The next phase was not only saying, I want to use less energy, but I want cleaner air. And yes, how, whether that meant low VOCs or taping or other methods, I want air quality.
Yeah.
That's the second wave. What's the next wave?
I can show you this really quickly because I brought some props, if you don't mind. But this is a New York house in Brooklyn. And this picture here shows after a month of using the air filter. So this is incoming air into the house, and this is what the new filter looks like. This is another picture of one
a coffee
set up
filter
in the bathroom. Yeah, I mean,
I think that was just a picture of my windowsill.
Yeah, so that is the air that you breathe, and it's not just the New York air that's polluted. It's also the air inside your home. So most couches, carpets, all those things are old paints, things like that, are off-gassing for years and years. So all those chemicals are glues that we used in your house to put everything together. When you lay down floors and it's a floating floor, you have all this glue down there that's polyurethane, all this stuff, off gases. And when you're building airtight houses, you definitely notice that. You will smell it, and you will, you know, you need to get rid of those things. The amazing thing about living in an airtight house is that you have to bring in air constantly.
All right.
Sorry about that.
How how much is it, how much are they asking for it? Do you have to sell them on the, or are consumers sufficiently sensitized to this that they're coming and saying, I want a healthier building. I want a healthier house. I want, Scott, I want you to build me something. What are my options? Are they asking for it yet? I know that in the world of cars, we all get, you know, the choices for a Tesla. We know what the cost of the Tesla is. We know what the subsidy is. We know how much gas is going to save us. You know, the world's been educated. I don't think that the world's been educated on green building. And I don't know that they're asking for it yet. Are they?
I don't think they're asking for it yet because when you're coming into a place like New York City in particular, you kind of, you have your selections. And the majority of these buildings are just, they don't meet those standards. A lot of the new buildings coming in, and we'll discuss one that we're bringing to market, have that option. They can do that. So I think for somebody to come in and say, I only want a clean building, I only want an environmentally friendly living situation, I want a clean living situation, they're gonna have maybe two or three buildings that are options for them. So they're not really coming and saying, this is how I wanna live. But if they're looking, you know, at the scope of what's available to them, something like that will probably come up in their search, and that's when they'll have that option to say, you know what, this, I didn't know that this was an option for me, and now that I know about it, this is much more meaningful to me than, you know, living on a particular street or you know, having however high ceilings or whatever it is. And I think that people are getting a lot more educated. It started with the cars, and it's a conversation. I mean, with global warming and all of that, all of this is just a conversation that people are having more and more and more, and they're getting educated.
Anna, will people pay a premium for that?
I think so. But at the same time, I mean, when we're comping our building, we're not really adding a premium for it because we don't really believe that you should have to pay for clean air, you know, which pay extra for clean air, but you are buying a newly constructed building, and there's a premium that comes with that. So I think that you can probably add a premium to it.
Does it cost more to build? Does it cost more to build right now?
It's a tough question. I mean, yeah, I would say that it's pretty close to parity. I would say it's maybe you're looking at a 5% increase, maybe. But it's close to parity. It depends on where
you're
going.
So is that a 5% increase that a developer would say, look, you know, let's do this, so I got to build in that 5%.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an economic aspect that people always think about. But I think where the developers miss the point is that I think that I think Tesla is the example, right? Nobody thought that they needed a $60,000 electric car 10 or 15 years ago when the only option out there was a Nissan Leaf 1.0. And Elon Musk went out there and he built it and he gave people that option, and people then started to talk about it. And I think that's starting to happen. I can't tell you how many people have approached me and called me, because I know that, you know, I'm involved with passive house technology, who've called me and asked me, how can I do a passive house? And, you know, how can we build that? It's definitely a movement that's coming. And I also think, you know, all it takes is a few articles in the New York Times to talk about not just the energy efficiency, but also the health part of it. We spend thousands of dollars extra paying for organic foods. I remember my dad when organic foods started to become popular 20 years ago. He was like, it's humbug. Why pay the extra for it? And a lot of people said that. And now everybody's buying organic foods. And why would you not, you know, you're putting a few chemicals from a banana into your body. Why would you not want to live in a place where you're not putting all those exponentially more chemicals into your body from the air than
you would from food? But I think also it's important to note that a developer that does it right, they shouldn't be doing it as a fad or as a trend. They should be doing it because it's a passion of theirs. And that's the only way that they're going to do it right. The developer that we're working with, he makes choices based on how is this going to be the best product. And this might cost a little bit more money, but it's going to be the lower VOC option. And that's what we're going for, because it's important to him and it's meaningful to him. So to do it right, it's got to be somewhat innate.
Scott Hobbs, I know you're dying to dive in here.
Sorry, we're yapping.
Well, Scott has apartments in the city and he does houses. And so I heard it might only cost a 5% premium. Can you comment on that?
Well, there's questions as to how far you want to go. And that drives a lot of the cost. And so, I mean, yeah. One difference for us is that we're doing custom products. So literally we're working with specific owners who get to see the price tags and get to decide how far they want to go. We start at a very high level. And then you can tweak it going up. But if somebody has like asthmatic children, if they have really bad allergies, if they have something serious, you can really kind of, you know, get the air quality even up to a whole different level. But now you're doing a lot more HEPA filters. You're doing a lot more treatments of air. You're exchanging air differently. It has to be a little bit, you have to do something different that can add to the cost. On the other hand, like spec builders, it's not unusual for a speculative builder in a house to have a mechanical system that costs half of what we would start as kind of our basic model inside of the homes that clients want from us. So it's, I mean, you're still allowed to go ahead and not do things the way that you really want to. And I'm sure that happens in the big buildings too. I'd say one slight difference is, of course, in the bigger buildings with 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 apartments or 100, there's an ownership element to the overall efficiency of the building that hopefully they end up taking some sort of understanding. And again, in New York City, air quality does take on a whole different meaning than the country. I mean, you got allergies in the country, but
I think the car example is good here. An analogy is that it costs very little to buy a car that will go from 0 to 60 in 8 seconds to upgrade into one that does it in 6 seconds, but it costs a lot of money to get one that goes from 2 seconds to 1.8 seconds. And I think it's the same in buildings like this. So, I mean, you can really, you know, you can add a lot to buildings. We were just talking with our developer this morning and with our architects, and he was saying, you know, we've been thinking about adding this LED UV system into the building that you know basically kills all the viruses in the air ducts. And I was like, you know, that sounds great, but it's going to cost a lot of money. And what is it going to give you at the end of the day? And those types of things, I think, you know, it's like going from you know, Waterworks up to Lefroy Brooks, right? I mean, that it costs a lot more, but is still just getting water out of the faucet. And I don't know if it looks.
And then there's also the maintenance aspect of something like that. I mean, to maintain something like that and keep it clean, yes, that's a monster of a job.
So when I've asked Scott, let's get specific on our choices here. When I built my house 5 years ago, I decided to do geothermal heating and cooling because it would save me money over the long, because it was an economic decision and the government was offering 20% tax break. So I could write 20% of it off. So that was an easy decision. But when I went to Scott and I said, well, what's the next level up? He said, well, you would get air exchangers. You would want to bring in fresh air. You wouldn't want to just a sealed envelope. You want to exchange air and get new fresh air and conditioned. And
you have to.
You want that? And I was like, I don't think I need that. I mean, I don't think I need that. The next level is, do you want your air humidified? Do you want the humidity control so that in the winter, the humidity doesn't drop too low and in the summer, you know, go too high? And I didn't appreciate, right? So I can appreciate the economics that I can measure. I can't appreciate the healthiness, which is what you were talking about, the healthiness of air scrubbers and humidifiers and air exchangers. So I still think they're not well understood. They're not well understood by me. I do have fancy filters. My filters cost me $60 each. They're like 5 inches fat. They're like MERV 12. And then I swap them out every 6 months. And then I feel like, okay, I did enough. I don't need to go to, you know, I don't need to go to the 1.8 second, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You went to like 85%. Yeah, no, which is fine. I mean, it's fine. The only thing you have to be careful of and that I really want to like tell everybody out here is, and this is the mistake that a lot of like construction people and developers and homeowners are making right now, is that they're going in and they're using, for example, zip systems, which are these boards that go up, they get taped up, and you can actually seal a house pretty easily and very inexpensively with them. And what happens is that sometimes you seal up the houses and you do need to have airflow. And if you don't have the airflow, you will get mold. And so this happened back like 20 years ago in Germany, which, you know, like every other house that's built now is passive house standard. But 20 years ago, a lot of guys came out and they didn't know what they were doing. And there was a huge crisis because all these homes had mold in them. But you need to, yeah. So if you're going to seal up your house,
we have that
hyper-insulated, you need to have an ERV that circulates fresh air into the home, but which is also amazing because when you're like sleeping, all you do is breathe out CO2. Your bedroom is just filled with CO2, fresh air coming in every day. I only need to sleep like 2 hours a night because I've got fresh oxygen coming into my bedroom every night. Like it's amazing. Like, look at me. I'm like the freshest guy around.
That's so light a match in there.
I'm not selling $500 million because I'm not getting enough fresh air.
And you're not getting enough oxygen. That's the problem. Yes.
Now I know.
Yeah. See, that's why in Colorado they have oxygen bars. And this, I never understood that. They have like oxygen bars, you know, up in like Aspen and stuff. They charge you like, you know, $500 for an hour of sitting there and sucking air.
So let me just ask, we're talking a lot about employing these things, but it's all from a development standpoint, a new development. What if someone lives in a pre-war building or even a post-war building, but they want to live cleaner? They want to live, you know, more sustainably. What can they do within their own apartment, or can they not, to go down this path?
I think it's difficult. I mean, I think what you can look at is you can look at the materials that you are bringing into your home. So if you're going to sand your floors, you know, do a natural oil finish. Don't do a polyurethane finish. If you can get the building to replace the windows, use a good quality, at least dual paned window that, you know, has a high quality. All those things will definitely matter at the end of the day. And I mean, we all know building boards. So unfortunately, sometimes, you know, if they can't even decide to change a doorbell, it takes them 10 years. But, you know, for the most part, I think that, you know, there's very inexpensive technology out there that you can use or options out there that you can use today that are not going to cost you a lot more money.
So if someone gut renovates an apartment on Park Avenue, they have an 8-room apartment on Park Avenue, they're going to completely gut it. There are things that they can do and employ.
Oh, totally. Yeah, okay. Totally. I mean, if you're looking at pre-war buildings, I mean, a lot of those buildings are amazing. They were built so well. They don't build buildings like that anymore. They've got thick walls. You can insulate on the inside of them. And if you use a triple pane window on those, which will keep sound out as well, you can totally. Again, you have to be careful. So you probably have to put in an ERB because you can insulate those extremely well. I mean, I sit in my home when it's 20 below out by the window and I do not feel a draft. And the same temperature, the same environment is there when it's 100 degrees out. There's no change in my home. I never have to put on sweaters or take off my clothes. It's always like, yeah, just a comfortable environment.
All right, we've got 15 minutes to go. We can keep going on green building, or you can tell us about the current environment in New York. I mean, I want to know what's going on because I heard there was this pandemic and the market was a little bit soft. For about the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, the media really seems to be calling for a sharply upward trajectory in New York. Is that the case?
Absolutely. It's been the case. It's been on the way up since December. And it's, I mean, a true New Yorker doesn't give up on believing in New York. So we believe in New York. And everything comes around. We've been in the business a long time and have gone through so many different natural disasters and man-made disasters, and New York always comes back. Obviously, this is a very different animal, but starting with December, I mean, the prices had adjusted so well towards a buyer's market, and a lot of people were able to finally build equity in New York, finally buy an apartment, buy a family apartment, buy a starter apartment, whatever they wanted, you know, whatever they wanted, they were priced back in. So once that started happening, and then there was a little bit of media that went around it, you know, you get one article and then you get more people kind of diving in because they're afraid they're missing the bottom. Then you get another article. And then lately there's just been a lot of really positive press, which is great. But now everything is, there are bidding wars everywhere. People are really, really coming out of the woodwork and saying, okay, we're on the upswing. That's very clear, but the prices are still, it's still very, very price sensitive. So you can't really start increasing prices until the pandemic is, you know, relatively done. And, but at the same time, bidding wars are increasing those prices anyway. So there's a mentality about, you know, I've missed the bottom, but the pricing is still not at the top. So it's still a really good time to buy.
Yeah. The good inventory is almost gone. I mean,
it's almost gone. Yeah.
I mean, there's some apartments out there that are still, I think, steals, but there's very few and far between on those. There's some that have been sitting on the market that I think you can get a steal on. But besides that, I mean, the good inventory is not out there, and it's not coming on the market either. People are not selling. They're staying in the city. And I think a lot of people are realizing, you know, there's no Broadway in Naples, Florida. You know, there's no Met or Guggenheim in Scarsdale. I'm sorry, but New York is, you know, the most amazing city in the world. And it's fine to go on vacation for a year, you know, out in the Hamptons or you know, down in Florida. But when it comes to it, you know, I think people are realizing there's a reason why they fell in love with New York in the first place.
Yeah.
And people will come back. And I think we're looking at the roaring 20s, and real estate prices are going to recover extremely quickly. I mean, I remember back in like 2008, 2009, I had guys out there who were like, oh, the market's going to keep going down, keep going down. They missed out on so much. By 2010, they were like, whoa.
They were gone. Yep.
It was What's like Formula One cars, and a lot of them.
What's good inventory mean? What's good?
Good inventory is...
I've heard condos are hot, co-ops not so much. Are we looking at brownstones? Are we talking about
Brooklyn? No, just...
No, I don't think it's a category. I think it's more like good light, good views, some outdoor space, good condition, good quality, things like that.
Good neighborhood.
But I will also say that so many people were so concerned about the longevity of New York because people could now work from home and they understand that they can work from home. So why would they want to pay New York City prices? And, you know, to Beau's point, people want to pay New York City prices because when you're spending all your time sitting in your computer in your house or in your apartment, the last thing you want to do is walk out of your apartment and there's no one around. In New York, you can actually still socialize there. You know, you walk down the street and there's people bundled up in the middle of the winter sitting outside, you know.
I want to get more specific. I want to know how it's changed. I'm going to give you an analogy. In Connecticut, the pandemic has caused the commutable towns to be less important because of the pandemic, because people are taking the trains less and commuting into the city less. So it's changed the equation out in the suburbs. What are some of the changes that are occurring in New York City as a result of the pandemic that causes something to be good inventory? Do I care about subways as much as I used to, subway accessibility, or is the Lower East Side just fine these days?
Lower East Side is just fine, I will say. I've been very busy. But
you're talking about a blip on the radar. It's a blip on the radar. Everything will come back. There are going to be some more people who are going to work from home, but yeah, all those commuter towns you're talking about, Connecticut, I will tell you that because, you know, you guys out there have a lot of people who've moved out there, you know, traffic's going to increase exponentially over the next year. I will guarantee you that I'm pretty sure that in a year and a half, you will see a flight out of Connecticut because there are going to be guys out there who don't want to necessarily live out there because they want to live in New York. Nothing against Connecticut. I love Connecticut. But there are guys out there who want to be in the city And all of a sudden, you know, they're going to be like, I don't want to sit in traffic for 2 hours a day. And
I love listening to people make their predictions, whatever the disaster is, whether it's, you know, Lehman crash in 2008 or this. People make their predictions and they're so steadfast in their belief that, you know, either New York is done or no one's ever going back into offices again. I mean,
I want your predictions.
My prediction.
You just heard
that
our predictions.
You've heard our predictions.
Our predictions.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was hilarious remember that article Jerry Seinfeld wrote, and it was in retaliation to, I forget who wrote something about New York.
Comic guy who owns Stand Up New York, and he's a finance guy.
Exactly. So it went back and forth between them a couple of times. And I mean, it was fascinating because you can't make these, or you shouldn't make these big predictions in an unprecedented time in our life. We really have no idea, or we had no idea how things were going to pan out. But at the end of the day, I mean, New York is still going to be New York. Broadway's always going to come back. I mean, to me, that it was just, it felt really silly when people were to make those predictions and say that, you know, something that's such a monumental part of Manhattan is just never going to come back.
But Anna, in that itself, you are also making a prediction, which I'm a believer in New York like nobody's business. And it's also our collective predictions that are trying to change the narrative, which is making everybody feel that, you know what, it's okay.
It's okay.
Everything's exactly. Cool here.
Well, I mean, the negative predictions were all just very short-sighted. This is what's happening right now. And if things don't change based on what's happening right now, then sure, those predictions could have come true. But we all knew that at some point, this was all going to come to an end. We're not there yet, but we will be. And to have that long-term belief, that's really, I don't think it's a prediction. I think it's just a hold on, take a deep breath, people. Sure. Everything's going to be fine. You know, I mean,
there's positives that come out of pandemics. You know, there are, as awful as this has been, there are positives that are going to come out of it. There's curbside dining. I am pretty sure that the city is going to grandfather in curbside dining for restaurants now, which means more space.
Freaking havoc on parking, but.
Exactly.
All right, fine, whatever. But there's no parking anymore anyway.
You can't park on the Upper West Side if you try.
You know, actually, maybe they'll get rid of cars. That's fine with me too, like they have in London. But they've got curbside dining. There's walking streets, you know, things like pedestrian streets popping up everywhere. I think those are things that hopefully the administration will, and future administration here in New York, will appreciate and see and bring forward, because I think those things will only enhance the city and make it a more livable city. And I hope that's going to be the trajectory that we're on. And I think it is.
Yeah.
I'm going to be positively optimistic about that.
All right. Give me one hot property or one hot neighborhood that is currently hot and getting hotter. I'll give you an example. Backcountry Greenwich seemed to be out of favor. It would take you 20 minutes to get from backcountry Greenwich, you know, downtown to get your groceries. The pandemic has caused the 4-acre zone in North Stamford, North Greenwich, Wilton to be suddenly, you know, popular. And I predict that will last for this next several years, whether or not we have a pandemic or not. What's the equivalent in New York?
That's a tough one, I think. I mean, the tried and true neighborhoods like the West Village, Upper West Side, Upper East Side, they're still tried and true. I've experienced something really interesting in the Lower East Side where I live, in that the prices didn't really dip all that much to begin with, or maybe in just the co-op environment where I am, it just didn't. And it's a really a destination spot for a lot of people, but it has been for a long time. So I'm not sure that answers your question necessarily, but that's definitely not changing or going away. And I think there are some neighborhoods that are, you know, that people started living in because they couldn't afford to be more central. Those might die down a little bit because they're too far from transportation. So I think that's a tough one.
To me, I would say actually around you, On the Lower East Side. I mean, with Essex Market, and I think it's changed from being sort of like this like loud and boisterous bar scene to really being a livable area.
It is. I mean, I know the Lower East Side intimately, but I also live in the lower half of it. So I live south of Delancey, where it's not, you don't have a crazy bar scene there. It's just a very, very different, different culture. But the, I mean, the, with Essex Crossing and all the amenities that brought to a neighborhood that desperately, desperately needed it, that was well before the pandemic. They continued work through the pandemic. There's going to be a ton more coming in over the next couple of years. They're going to be upgrading the East River Park, which, you know, is to a lot of people's dismay, but I think ultimately it will be a good thing. And I mean, all of these things contributed to an area that really kind of needed it. And that doesn't go away because there's a pandemic. It actually makes it that much more livable because during a pandemic, I was there the entire time. I didn't go away until the summer, and it was absolutely wonderful to be there. There are a lot of parks. There's a lot of open space. People are really respectful of each other. And I've definitely seen an uptick in, you know, how do I get an apartment in your building? I mean, it's miraculous. And the prices, as I said, they didn't really dip.
You live a little close to One Manhattan Square, right?
Ish, maybe a 10-minute walk.
Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for that building?
It's tough. It's tough.
The multiplicity of product that they have is insane.
Yeah. It's insane. No. So the issue with that, first of all, it's a gorgeous building. The amenities are stunning. The location happens to be really great. You're not that far from the F train. I happen to love the F train. A lot of people don't. But I mean, the issue with that is that there are these communities. The Knickerbocker development, for one, is right around there. And that's a huge community that isn't going to be going anywhere. It's not really changing the dynamic or the landscape of it. Where if you know, like Hudson Yards, for example, you build something crazy there, you can also build around it to make sure that the amenities match the building, or the neighborhood amenities match the building. The opportunity for that isn't quite there.
There's
a couple of rental buildings coming into the neighborhood too. But I live in one of those old co-op developments, and they're massive, massive structures with tons of people. I happen to love that. And I love like the culture and the diversity that brings, but somebody, you know, that wants those crazy amenities, they also want to walk out their door and have other options. And you do have to walk a few blocks to have those other options.
Yeah, there's no retail there. I mean, there's no room for like organic growth, and that's I think they missed the boat on that one. I'm gonna throw in just Brooklyn as a whole. I mean, Brooklyn sailed through this pandemic just like 2008. Prices, you know, there may be a couple of good deals, but that was it.
Yes, Bill lives in Brooklyn.
Yeah, he's in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I live in Didymus Park. I love Didymus Park. It's like living in Mayberry with all the amenities of a big city and a 50-minute drive to Tribeca, or a 30-minute train into Union Square.
Have you been there, John? Have you been there? If I dropped you there, you wouldn't know where you are. You wouldn't think you're in New York.
You think you're in Greenwich.
You wouldn't.
It's amazing.
And it's important to note that it's a standalone house. It's not a townhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whenever somebody talks about their house in New York, you're thinking townhouse. This is a standalone with a yard.
Sounds expensive.
They're about to list an $11 million house around the corner from me, which is crazy. I mean, normally most of the houses they used to go for, or 10, 15 years ago, they were going for $1 million at the most. And then they've been creeping up now over the $3 million price point for these Victorian, 2.5 to 3.5. But there's a couple of big mansions in the neighborhood on Albemarle that are just, I mean, they're stunning. And they've got one coming on right now for $11 million.
That $11 million house must be green, right?
I wish it was.
So one thing I haven't heard about is the mix of jobs. I think that Wall Street is shrinking in terms of the number of jobs, but I think it's more than being made up for, according to the press, by tech. Tech is moving into New York. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing a new young tech worker coming into the brokerages and saying, you know, I've been transferred to New York. I need a place. Where are the cool neighborhoods?
I think that's going to come more and more as the office space develops, because it's not really developed yet. There are some, spaces for Google, but the amount of office space square footage that Google, Amazon, IBM has committed to is extraordinary for people that really could probably work from home.
Several million feet.
Yes.
Oh yeah, no. We have a small rental.
Yeah, so once that's built, we're going to see a lot more of it, but a lot of it is still in the works.
We have a small $3,000 rental in Chelsea, and every third person coming through there is a programmer, either for Facebook or for Google.
And what does the programmer for Facebook or Google, what is their target shelter? What are they looking for? Are they saying, I just want a rental? I want to buy, I need a co-op, I need a condo. Do they say I'm looking 5 years out, or I want my forever house? What is the young tech worker asking for?
It depends on the age, right? So the younger ones are just looking for great neighborhoods with bars, and, everything that New York gives you, right? That's what they're looking for. I think the older tech workers definitely are some of the ones who pumped up Brooklyn, townhouses, things like that, but also Soho, Tribeca, have seen a huge influx of tech guys. I think even more so than Wall Street guys right now. I mean, most of the sales I think that we've done downtown have been a pretty good mix of people who are either in tech and less so in finance these days.
Are those groups gonna, you didn't say Upper West Side, you didn't say Upper East Side. Are they sort of, old lady neighborhoods, or are they going to become hip too?
Yeah, it's hard to hipify the Upper East Side, but there are pockets that are actually coming around and the great thing about the Upper East Side and Upper West Side, I mean, both of them, they're right on Central Park, so you have this amazing park right at your doorstep. And if you're on the other side, you've got Riverside and you've got East River Park. There's all these great outdoor spaces up there. And what they were missing was a little bit of coolness factor, right? I mean, they were missing art galleries and cool restaurants, but they're coming in, and
The people that were priced out of Manhattan are priced back in, and especially in those neighborhoods, because the further east you go, you can actually find something on East End Avenue that is light and beautiful for a price that you would never have imagined, especially, given that there is a train closer to it with the Q now. But there are some buyers that I'm working with that are really excited they can actually build some equity in New York, and they didn't necessarily want to be uptown, but we're looking uptown because they can actually get a home for their entire family that is comfortable for now,
Anna and I no longer have to bring our passports when we go up there,
right? we no longer get nosebleeds either.
can I throw something in about the Upper West Side? I know a little bit about it.
You do.
If you look at Greg Heim's inventory report, the two-bedroom market is a seller's based on absorption. Every market other than a three-bedroom market is a balanced market, leaning more towards a seller's market. By the end of May or the beginning of June, it will be a seller's market in every market on the Upper West Side, with the exception of the three-bedroom market.
Agreed.
So, it doesn't have the cool factor for a very good reason. It is not supposed to be a cool neighborhood. It is a family neighborhood. It has, people talk about Central Park. The heck with Central Park. You want to go to a park, go to Riverside Park, where nobody goes. And lastly, and please take this the right way, John. okay, and anybody from Connecticut, because I love Connecticut. But you guys needed a pandemic of a market, out of the hell of a market. We're not worried about the pandemic. New York stands all by itself. It doesn't need any help. Connecticut needed a pandemic for the market to turn around. I couldn't. I had to defend New York. I had to defend New York.
It's hard to stump John.
Yeah.
But I want to tease out of that. So if I'm in the market looking, what I hear you saying is that in a balanced market, you talked about a whole lot of sellers markets, but you said there's balance in the two bedroom sector. That to me
means sellers market. Everything else is a balance.
Okay.
Except for the three bedroom market, which is still a buyer's market. So the
studio market. So I can get my deals uptown. All the deals, I should start uptown if I'm looking for a deal. I'm not going to get it.
For the most part, yeah.
The inventory on the Upper West Side, one of the things that's helping the Upper West Side is the inventory is very tight.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why it's a seller's market. And that's why the two bedroom market is a seller's market. Okay, because you have a reduced, your inventory is getting eaten up and new stuff isn't coming on. And your studio one bedroom markets are now a little bit more in balance between sellers and buyers, but moving much more quickly to the seller right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's no longer a buyer's market. Larger apartments buyer market. And that's been the case for a long while. I mean, that has nothing to do with the pandemic.
I think the Upper West Side versus the Upper East Side too, the architecture appeals to more people who are moving to New York or buying New York. I mean, the architecture for the most part, on the Upper West Side is pre-war, whereas, you get east of Lex and it's mostly post-war stuff on the Upper East Side. And that's where you really are getting your deals because, you've got low ceiling heights, they're big buildings, they're maybe not as sexy. Architecturally speaking, they're like blah, but you can actually create great apartments in there. You live on the inside of an apartment, you don't live on the outside of a building. So I think that there's actually a lot of opportunity there to come in and make great apartments on the Upper East Side and get a deal.
All right, so three bedrooms on the Upper East Side, it'd be an opportunity for somebody to say trade up from a two bedroom to a three
bedroom. Exactly.
Yeah.
And start there. And if they couldn't find it on the Upper East Side, where else would they go?
There's tons of places.
Midtown East.
Midtown. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Murray Hill, Kips Bay, those areas.
I would also go further north. I would go up in Harlem. I would go up to Washington Heights. All those neighborhoods are definitely hot right now. And I think they're great investments. There's a lot of people who are moving, further north.
Yeah.
Well, if everything in your neighborhood is trading at $11 million, then we're definitely gonna stay out of Brooklyn. And it sounds like Anna's neighborhood, the Lower East Side, is way too hip and cool.
You can come visit. I'll shield you and protect you as we walk the streets. Don't worry.
We give everybody Kevlar vests.
I grew up in Stuyvesant Town from 1967, 69 to 1980. And the Son of Sam was out. Yeah. Mayor Beam and then Mayor Koch were running the show. And I was told, do not go south of 14th Street. Do not go south of 14th Street. And if I did, I might get mugged for my skateboard or whatever. So when I mentioned this to Beau yesterday, he said the scariest thing in the Lower East Side was what?
Oh, that woman from Jersey or Queens or whatever who went nuts at Essex Market.
Oh my God!
Non-mask wear,
That was insane. That was livid about that. But John, I know you're going to ask me about Astor Place Barber.
Yes.
My son actually. So John's question to me off camera was, can you still get an $8 haircut at Astor Place Barbershop? So first of all, my son goes there. He started going there when it was 16 a haircut. It is now up to $23 a haircut, which is crazy. $23.
John, you're priced out.
And it's seriously. And but I will say that this is a kind of nice story to maybe wrap on, because Astor Barber was going to close because of the pandemic. There was no business to be had. They were supposed to close on a Tuesday. That Tuesday, somebody came in and bought them because they wanted to keep the barbershop open because it's such an institution. So by the Wednesday after that, they were back in business full swing. Literally, it happened overnight.
Wow. That's fabulous.
Isn't it great? Now we bring our son somewhere else because it's too expensive.
is Canal Street Jeans still there?
I don't think so. That one I'm not really sure about.
Canal Street's actually going through a huge metamorphosis.
Canal Street's going to be pretty incredible. Give it a few years, but
it's going to be too hip for me soon.
It's going to be incredible.
All right.
But it's going to be like 42nd Street, that what it used to be in Times Square, and it's going to become that?
No.
Okay.
No.
You've got beautiful cast iron loft buildings on both ends.
Yeah.
It's a one street that divides two of the city's hottest neighborhoods. I'm surprised it hasn't happened already. But
we're talking about guys like Keith McNally coming in and opening restaurants.
Yes.
You're talking Keith Baltazar style.
It's very good.
It's a great street. It really is a great street.
So if I want to make a 20-year bet, I might look in that neighborhood, because I don't necessarily need the deal of the year, but if I'm sticking around for 20 years, I should look downtown, because some of these fabulous restaurants are coming in and it's just
What you have in a lot of these buildings, especially along Canal, is rent stabilized tenants who have been there for 40 years. I would buy those lofts, wait for them to, kick it a little bit or a lot, or just buy them out. But at some point, if you just buy them, let those people live their lives, those will be worth so much more money someday.
Yeah. Look at Tribeca. Tribeca used to be like 3 blocks by like 7 blocks. Now it's like 200 blocks by 500 blocks, it's all expanding, very quickly down there.
Broadway south of Canal, right there, that stretch has really changed. One of my colleagues used to call it, because people would say, "Oh, this is Tribeca." He's like, "No, that's Tribeca stand."
Yeah.
That's got a lot of runway.
And it's beautiful.
Yep.
Oh, I love ending the show with a tip, like a big secret. Like, I'm going to go take Wall Street winnings and I'm heading down to Canal Street. I love this. All right.
And everyone on the show gets 10% of your earnings.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thanks, guys. Thank you so much.
All right. And
Scott, good to see you. Michael. Itzy.
And to have a cup of coffee with you down on maybe Astor Place.
Hi, Roberto.
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure and my treat.
Hi, Michael. Hi, everyone.
See you guys.
I want some love too here. Hi.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Tammy.
Johnny. We'll see you.
Hey, be apologized, Tammy. It's the New York crew.
Okay. I'm a loyalist.
Connecticut, Connecticut love. We love Connecticut.
I'm a loyalist. John knows I'm a fan.
We love Tammy.
We love you back.
I'll be showing in 2 minutes. I got to go.
Bye, everyone.